everybody. Ray Lucchese here with
Howard Marks here.
Welcome to the next episode of Graybeards on Storage Monthly Podcast, a show where we get Graybeard storage and system bloggers to talk with storage system vendors and others to discuss upcoming products, technologies, and trends affecting the data center today. This is our 33rd episode of Graybeards on Storage, which was recorded on June 9th, 2016. We have with us here today Frederick Von Herren, founder of High Fence Consulting and former senior director of HPC at Nuance. Well, Frederick, tell us a little bit about some of your experiences at Nuance.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so I started about 10 years ago in high performance, and it was kind of weird in the sense that I was running text-to-speech for R&D, and since I touched Linux and Windows and other flavors of Unix, I guess I was the perfect candidate to start high-performance computing at Nuance. In those days, high performance basically meant there were 10 desktops connected to the main network, and that was it, right? That was the great high performance computing environment. And so my management was telling me in those days that speech recognition needs a lot of data in order to improve the products, right? So speech recognition is a statistical application. You're saying something, and then the application is trying to compare that with a subset of data. And then hopefully, from a statistical standpoint, the application can guess really what you're saying. So the mainstream idea was, let's start collecting as much data as we can afford, because cost was still the driver. And then let's see how far we can push that. So in the beginning, we started out with hiring a company that would provide us guidance on storage, on servers, and high-performance file systems. And, you know, once we got all the equipment in, I kind of realized that there were a lot of nuances, if I can say it like that, of, you know, between raw storage and actual capacity, you know, multi-core, single core. And I got interested in knowing more on what's behind all of this. One thing I learned really quickly is there is always a bottleneck. The question is,
where?
Where it is, and provide a platform, if you wish, that you can control as an individual and replace pieces as you go along. Because I believe that if you own the platform, you could replace vendor A with vendor B and improve performance and hide the complexity from users. So one of the things we decided to do is to swap out the original high-performance file system with IBM GPFS.
GPFS.
Yes, GPFS. They call it Spectrum Scale nowadays, I believe. So that's about 8 years ago. We wanted to look for a reliable and a scalable piece of software that could glue our storage devices together and make it look like one, right? So a little bit of a fast forward from a user perspective. Our users are seeing the exact same file systems as they saw 8 years ago, but we have to replace the hardware behind it four times, right? So if you own the platform, something like GPFS, you have the power and control to make those decisions. Because I came from R&D next to GPFS, for some reason I was convinced that I needed three tiers of storage. And don't ask me why, because I really don't know. It was a gut feeling where I needed like high performing, medium, and then low performing. And so I was asking people, what do you think, you know, high performance, medium, and average? And at some point we stumbled over a company that did ATA over Ethernet.
And oh, our friends at our former friends at CoRaid.
There you go. And so we said, look, why don't we try with, you know, a few shelves, you know, super micro, all that good stuff, 25 drives per shelf. So we started, and to a certain degree, we kind of said, well, what if we buy 40 of those shelves, and how far can we push it? And before we know, we had 1,000 drives of CoRaid, and based on SATA drives, 500 terabyte SATA drives, and performance was reasonable in the sense, you know, considering SATA drives and the amount of drives we had. The only problem was having 2,000 drives of that really was not an option. It was, management of it was a pain. Failure of drives was very, very difficult. At some point, we even decided that we would put webcams on the shelves just to see when the drives would fail. So
what, the lights?
The lights, yes.
You're kidding me. So this is your management?
Well, you know, this was the whole idea with CoRaid. It was, you know, we will make these things really stupid. And if your goal is to be really stupid, it's easy to achieve.
That's right. And so one thing I learned out of it is that, you know, having a tier one and tier two and tier three wasn't really a necessity. I did understand that with good basic equipment, you could scale it out if the hardware would allow you to scale out. So at some point we said, you know, co-rate, that's great, but that's not going to work for us. We wanted to go a step up. So we wanted to go really with a JBOD that had relatively good management tools and preferably CLI, because high performance computing is all about automation. I mean, nobody's going to log in into 1,000 servers manually. So you want to do all of this in an automatic fashion. And that's how we started working with HP. And we asked HP, so what kind of JBOD with management tools can we use and get off the ground? And then before we know, we started working with the MSAs, version 1, version 2, version 3. Then they renamed it to P2000. Then we had up to 12,000 drives of MSAs.
And wide striping across 12,000 drives solved your performance problem, so you didn't need a faster tier?
Yeah, so the way you should look at it, the MSA had 96 drives per dual controller. And so we purchased blocks. On one hand, we had SAS drives. And I think in those days, we used a 300 gig 15K RPM. And then for slower storage, and we used the 750 gig SATA drives. So we called the SAS site, we called it Scratch because it's heavy-duty read-write. And then we used and called the SATA site Static. Basically, this is incoming data from users, and we're not going to modify that data. So we're going to write it once but read many times. And so with the help of GPFS, we would create RAID blocks within an MSA stack. And then we took a bunch of LUNs across multiple MSA stacks, and then we created file systems. So if you want to picture this, imagine that we have stacks of MSAs in multiple racks, and then you create a file system horizontally across all the different racks. And that's how you achieve your performance, right? If you want more performance, you add more racks and more LUNs to the file system. So 12,000 drives was doable.
Okay, and the MSAs were really a bit more than a JBOD because you were using the basic data protection.
That's right. That's right. We were looking from a price point, we were looking something as close as possible.
So Howard was right. You were wide striping the data across all 12,000 drives?
Yes. Yeah.
This would be a performer. This would be a screamer.
Yeah. Well, you know, 100 IOPS per drive, 12,000 drives.
Yeah, we're talking millions. Yeah, millions.
We're talking, you know, a lot of IOPS.
That's right. And so we had great luck with this whole environment, but from a growth perspective, you know, we were pretty much doubling every 18 months. So nobody was looking forward at 24,000 drives, right? So it's not because it worked really well with 12,000. So we were back with the same issue as we had with the core rates. Basically, was we're questioning ourselves about management, we're questioning ourselves about cost and scalability. So then we started looking at what's the next step. So where do we look? And just for your information, we test a lot of vendors, right? So what we're trying to understand is what the market has to offer, what performance, you know, what's the latency, the costs. And most importantly, at least from what we saw, is also support after purchasing the equipment is really, really important. And the way you can look at it is when you have that many hard drives, and certainly for the MSA, you are a statistic. So if there is an issue in the firmware, you're going to find it.
Right. This only affects 1 out of 10,000 drives.
Yeah, that would be...
Oh, that's me.
Yes. So, and it was interesting because there were cases where we started to find stuff before anybody else found it, right? So the moment they had a new firmware, we would wait a little bit. I mean, you don't always want to be the guinea pig. But at some point, you converged to the new firmware, and then you would realize, you know, here are the problems. So at some point, we started to decide to share all our logs with HP, the Colorado team, and they would regularly look into our log files to see if there's anything abnormal going on that would point to a bug in the firmware.
So when you're talking log files, you're not talking about storage per se, you know, the outboard logs for the drives or the storage controller, but your internal logs from your activity and console logs and those sorts of things. Is that what you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, that's right, yes. So we would work together with the Colorado team, and then they would ask us, here are the logs we want from our device, here are the logs we would like to see from your application, and then they would put one and one together, and then figure out what the issues were. And, you know, they found a decent amount of stuff. I mean, we were like analytics for them, right? So they have a new firmware. They would give it to us, and then we would pretty much tell them where the issues are.
Okay. And basically, this, what looks to me like 5 or 6 petabytes of data, is audio files of voice to use for statistical analysis?
It's combined. So typically, when a speech recognition happens, there are 2 files that are being generated. One is the, as you suspect, the WAV file, the binary file, which is the sound. And then there is a text file associated with it, which is a textual representation of what the system
right.
thinks was being said. So yes, by nature, it's a lot of small files. You know, what we try to do on the static side is to take a lot of those files together and tar them up to make them, you know, megabytes or gigabytes file. And sometimes we do that based on the metadata of the file. So, for example, we could put automotive data together, or in some cases, we would put that a tar file based on a customer. And then the scratch base is a little bit more the Wild West, right? Where scratch is heavy-duty rewriting, and that's where you can expect to see smaller files. And smaller files is a challenge to your metadata.
Oh, yeah.
It's also a challenge to your overall performance, but it's always a challenge to keep people in line. So every time new data is being added, we wanted to make sure that when they added more data, they would stack them in tar files.
You found GPFS was up to the scaling, I mean, from thousands of drives to 12,000 drives and beyond that?
Yes.
And the metadata, you know, I'm not sure what the metadata engine looks like in GPFS, was able to handle literally millions, if not billions, of files. Is that?
That's right.
I mean, every time I utter something to something like Siri, that would represent a separate file?
Yes.
Or two.
Yes. So the way you can look at it is that per second, GPFS is processing 2 or 3 million files. And so the GPFS product, you know, if you separate the backend data where the actual content of the file goes versus the metadata. So the metadata is the metadata of the files, right? Is pretty much like a database. It's a textual row by row, and each row identifies metadata information for a file or a directory. And it's challenging, right? Because metadata is not a lot of capacity, but you need a tremendous amount of IOPS, right? And that's why...
Frederick, when you're talking metadata, you're not talking about like standard NFS file metadata, but rather data that your systems are applying to indicate like it's automobile or somebody talking or...
No. I'm actually talking about file like an NFS
okay.
metadata.
POSIX metadata.
Yes. So, I mean, the way you can look at it is anytime a user wants to do something, they're going to hit the metadata, right? So even if they do a simple LS, they're going to hit the metadata. Now, when you talk about the voice metadata, that's where we used to put that into a Hadoop cluster. So there was a Hadoop cluster with 76 servers. And there you could put in a query for files. So for example, you could say, as a researcher, I want to know where all the American English files are at 8 kilohertz, female collected in automotive. That query, SQL query, would then go to the Hadoop cluster and will return with a list of paths to where the data is actually stored.
Wait a minute. You had a separate metadata server. A Hadoop cluster is a separate metadata server.
Yes.
Oh.
Well, you have to, right? So the last thing you want is when you have 12,000 drives is somebody to go into Unix and say, find me.
Yeah.
You're going to be gone for days. And the file that you were looking for could be there at the time you start your sequence, but it could be deleted in the middle of it, right? So you need something that's a lot more performing. We started out with Hadoop because we believed that Hadoop was a good use case, but then we switched over to HP Vertica, and our queries went from 12 minutes to 53 milliseconds or so. So that was a huge boost.
And Vertica is yet another scalable database service from HP?
Yeah. It's a product from HP and HPE, and it's a columnar database, right? So I'm not sure if you're familiar with columnar databases.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, but it's still a SQL database solution.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. And we went from 76 servers to 10.
Right. Ray?
Yes, sir.
Vertica is also the back end that Nimble uses for InfoSight.
Ah, that's interesting. I always thought they used Hadoop.
Nope.
That's a different discussion. Ah, interesting, interesting. So you mentioned that this is all statistically based. It seems like the world is moving towards, and I'm not sure what the right terms are, but neural net, deep learning, machine learning kinds of things. Is that transition happening for speech recognition as well?
Oh, yes. It's very important. So the software or the algorithm you use to compare, you know, whatever you're saying versus the data you're trying to compare it with, in the speech recognition world, typically you use an algorithm called hidden Markov. The challenge with that is it's a single core algorithm. So if you have a need for, let's say, 1,000 speech recognitions at the same time, you're going to need 1,000 CPU cores, right? And that's a lot of equipment once you want...
Wait a minute. Something like Siri that can be handling almost a million, right? I mean...
Yes.
You would need 1,000,000 cores?
That's right.
You can't virtualize this stuff?
No. I mean, virtualization doesn't give you more, right? So if the CPU runs at 3 gigahertz, virtualizing is not going to give you 6, right? It might tell you you're going to get 6, but you're not going to get more than 3. So the reality is, because of the algorithm, because of the single core approach, it was a bottleneck from a scaling perspective. And that's where machine learning and neural networking is coming into play. And you know, when I started working in speech recognition, you know, 15, 16 years ago, in those days, you were not going to run your speech recognition algorithm on a CPU. You were going to a DSP. And today, you know, what's the replacement for a DSP? It's a GPU, right? So you're going to go to a company like NVIDIA, and they will give you a lot more cores. Granted, the GPU cores are not as fast as the CPU cores. But for speech recognition, it doesn't really matter that much. It's really the amount of cores. So suddenly, with neural networking and NVIDIA, you have 3,000 cores or over 3,000 cores per GPU card, and you can assign a bunch of those cores to a recognizer, and now you can scale way, way beyond what you could do in the past. I give you, you know, some metrics, right? If you buy a 1U server, like a DL360, 2 sockets, you know, you end up with, 24, 28 cores or so altogether. If you buy a server that can host 8 GPU cards, typically there are about 4U, so 4 times more volume, but you get, you know, 8 times 3,000 cores, so that's 24,000 cores. Granted, they're GPU cores, so we have to be careful there, but for speech recognition, this is a huge boost. So in 4U, you have 24,000 cores, so you can scale and you can provide a lot more flexibility than before. Now, it does come with its own problems, right? So if you imagine that each CPU core needs access to a certain amount of IOPS and you go to GPUs, I mean, then the math is going the other direction, right?
Yeah, because now you've got 2 cores per spindle and that's going to be a problem.
Yes, and then you're a whole different ball game. But you know, that's why we have technology and innovation is to help you solve these problems. And if you want a lot of IOPS in a single point or a single server, there is technology out there that can do that for you. If you prefer a SAN architecture or distributed architecture, that's going to work for you as well. But yeah, like I said in the beginning, right? It's all about a bottleneck, and the bottleneck moves around, and you just need to find ways to improve the bottleneck and make sure that you control the platform in the sense that you can make a decision to go left or right without having to reteach your users on how to use the system.
Yeah, it's kind of the first lesson you have to learn as an IT architect is you never solve anything. You just move the bottleneck. It's way too frequently that I see people, especially in the early days of Flash, people would say, I have a storage performance problem. I only have 1,000 IOPS. Let me go to 1,000,000 IOPS. And, of course, at 10,000 IOPS, the bottleneck was someplace else, and they had already spent their whole budget for the year.
Yes, and I do like it, right? But it's, as you said, it's very difficult for people, certainly the people who have to pay for the whole thing, is that the bottleneck changes, right? They look at the bottleneck as a as something negative, while in reality, a bottleneck is just where you improve the performance of your environment and it just moving to somewhere else. But that doesn't mean that it's worse than before. It could, but not necessarily.
You mentioned that the machine learning, deep learning neural net, it has got a different scalability, I guess, if I call it properly, than the old statistical Markov, hidden Markov analysis. Can you explain that a little bit, Frederick?
Yes, it's all about the ability to parallelize, right? So if you look at a GPU card, for example, a GPU, it's running a single application, but the data is different. I mean, if we go to the basics, what does a GPU card do typically in a laptop, for example? The only application you're running is putting pixels on your screen, but from position to position, the pixels are going to be different. And so you can look at that as a highly parallelized application. And that's the same thing you're doing with the neural networking, where you basically say, I'm going to take a large task, I'm going to cut it into pieces, I'm going to give a bunch of cores a task or a set of data. They all run the same application, and at the end of the cycle, they all come back together and say, okay, we're going to take the data points with the highest return. From a CPU perspective, it's quite the opposite, right? Where with a CPU, you can run anything on a CPU or a core, so you can have two cores running two totally in different applications. But if the only thing you're trying to do is the same thing over and over with different data, then the ability of having the CPU doing two different things at the same time is not gaining you anything, right? So now they have an architecture where they create a tremendous amount of flexibility you're not going to use. You prefer to use technology where parallelization is built in.
So in the old hidden Markov approach was a CPU-based approach, and the new neural networks, a GPU-based approach. Is that how I read this?
Yeah, it's more about how wide you can parallelize. And because GPUs have the ability to go to the 1,000 cores, it's naturally a better way to use it. And, you know, in general, when I talk about GPU, you can use the word GPU by accelerator cards, right? So there's Intel also has Xeon Phi. There are other companies, you know, FGPAs. There's a lot of tools you can use depending on your use case. You need to understand how useful it's going to be to your use case, and then you choose what you want to do. I think Google actually came out with some new
TPUs, hardware. Right? Yeah.
That's right. So basically what that is exactly the same thing, except that for their particular use case, they found, you know, that one way of doing it was better than GPUs or FGPAs or Xeon Phi. In reality, it's all about use case. And same thing with storage, right? It all depends on your use case and how to use and how to pick the environment.
Yeah, and things get really interesting in the next couple of years when Intel comes out with the Xeons that include some FPGA built in.
Yeah, I think it's a natural thing, right? So when we talk about high-performance computing, it's kind of, you know, people say, oh, that's a niche and it's very specific. But since storage has become so cheap, a lot of people have enough storage and the ability to store a lot more data than they used to. And so they're really entering, to a certain degree, the world of high-performance computing without really wanting to call it high-performance computing.
Yeah, we're starting to see that the technologies of high-performance computing, like, you know, large clustered file systems like GPFS, move their way into the commercial data center.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, GPFS is kind of the old guard. You know, they have been around for long. Intel, although you would look at them as a hardware company, they are spending a lot of money on Lustre, which is a competitor to GPFS, which has some interesting features. You know, it's a fast-moving market. It's not being ignored. You have to keep track of all the different things. And the good thing there, as always, is you have options, right? Options depending on your use case.
Is GPFS open source?
No. It's proprietary. It's from IBM. And
no, I know it was IBM, but I didn't know whether it was open source.
No. Lustre has an enterprise paying version, also has open source, so you can start working with it without having to pay for...
There is some GPFS open source connection, though, because the Scale Computing guys started with GPFS before they developed their own object backend.
Yeah, but I think that was under license from IBM, though.
Oh, it's definitely under license, but they made a lot of changes to make it a distributed as in addition to clustered file system.
Yeah, there was another one besides Luster. There was a GFS, I think Red Hat has.
Yeah, GSF is pretty good as well, but it's not as scalable as the others. So if you want to use it up to 100 terabytes, that's okay. But I would use Luster or GPFS if you are going to use more than 100 terabytes.
You mean I can almost have my own HPC site in my basement here? If I have
yes.
enough server, I just need one of these 4U3000 core
that's
GPUs.
Nice.
24,000, sorry.
I got enough hardware. I just need an application. You know, that's the problem is you need to figure out, you know, infrastructure's grand, but it's really trying to solve a problem that matters.
You know, one of the questions that the data server, you know, data world has these days is how many people does it take to administer, you know, a 24,000 drive environment with two tiers of scratch and static and, you know, a Hadoop cluster? I mean, how many do you have admins in this world? I guess that's a question.
Yeah. So the first comment is we do a lot with automation. And so we are a 24/7 environment, but my people only work 9 to 5. That doesn't mean stuff doesn't happen after 5. It's just that the way the platform is built and the redundancy, there is no need to jump and run to the data center to replace something. So from an admin perspective, we have one guy in the data center to do break fix. As you can suspect, mechanical device break, they do break a lot. So a lot of his time goes to that. I have an operational team that mostly works on application changes with the users. So we don't have a standard application. Any script is considered an application. So there's a lot of work to work with the users to make sure that they don't destroy the environment. I mean, you can imagine, you know, if you need to write 1 megabyte, you don't want 1 million 1 byte files. You want a single 1 megabyte file. But you would be surprised sometimes, you know, that people don't understand scale. And then the engineering side, I have one main architect. I have one person who looks at open source community because we look a lot at Spark and that kind of stuff. And we do a lot of POCs. And then I have another person on the engineering side who works mostly on security, on automation tools, Xcat, Puppet, and that kind of stuff. So it's a relatively small, fast moving group.
And this is petabytes of storage, right? 5-6 petabytes of storage.
Yeah, that on block side, and then we have about 2 on the object side. So yeah. We hear that a lot. A lot of people tell us, you know, that we don't have a lot of people, but you know, it's you need to own the platform. You need to automate a lot and have a good understanding of high availability, right? So in other words, when you buy a storage device, you have to make sure that your power is well divided. I mean, now with the new device, it's not necessarily an issue, but if you look at the MSAs in the past, you know, if you wired it wrong, you would end up with 2 power supplies on the same PDU. The PDU would go down, and boom, you pretty much have data loss, right? So
yep.
It's making the right choice. It's you know, a lot of people ask me how we do it. I guess it's difficult to explain. For me personally, when we started, we just had 2 people, me and my main architect. For some reason, when we design something and look at stuff, I kind of feel where the weak points are. And we try to approach them and handle them. But we had issues in the past where we had bad batches of drives, bad batches of power supplies, and we never got hit by downtime because of the architecture.
You also had the advantage of not having 400 unique Snowflake applications that various departments bought that have to get supported.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
Yeah, the complication in the corporate data center, much of it comes from that.
Yes.
So back to the you keep talking about owning the environment. I think that because you went to GPFS, you can effectively replace anything underneath it that you want as long as it talks some sort of storage protocol. Is that kind of how I should understand that?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the storage protocol, but let's give you an example. So for example, a lot of the devices out in the market, they will do tiering for you, they will do snapshotting for you, but they all do it within the same device, right? So imagine, let's take an example. Let's assume I have 3 power devices and I want to build a file system across them. So horizontally, I build the file system across, you know, 3-part 1, 3-part 2, and 3-part 3. I want to be able to control the tiering, because if I tell 3-part 1, go ahead and start tiering, that's going to hit my performance, right? Because that device can decide to move data at any point in time, but it doesn't know what 3-part 2 and 3-part 3 is doing.
And it doesn't know anything about your data or your applications.
That's right.
You have so much more context that you can make more intelligent decisions.
Yes, and as a result of this, you know, we put the intelligence in GPFS and tell GPFS this is what you need to do, and that gives us, you know, there's pros and cons, right? So if somebody comes up with an incredible new way of doing things that we typically do at the GPFS level, yes, that's going to hurt us. But nowadays, we rely on basic functionality of storage devices. You know, 3PAR uses chunklet, so that works really well. But from a tiering and all that good perspective, we prefer to do that at the GPFS level for control. And as a result of this, we can say we're going to replace, you know, 3PAR with something else or upgrade the 3PAR and so on. And GPFS allows you to take a hardware device while it's in production. So, for example, if I say, you know, the example with the 3 3-PARs, if I want to upgrade 3PAR number 3, I can tell GPFS move all the data from 3 to 1 and 2. It will do that online, and then when all that's done, I can take 3PAR 3 out of production, and the users don't know anything. And then I can replace 3PAR 3 with, let's say, 3PAR 4, and then tell GPFS load balance the data that's on 1 and 2 now across 1, 2, and 4.
And all you're relying on the 3PAR of the MSA to do is provide basic resiliency.
Yeah, and that's how we went from, you know, co-rate to MSA to 3PAR. Our users are clueless on what we're doing. As a matter of fact, when we ask them, they have actually no idea. They still think we're running on the same storage devices we had 8 years ago.
Okay, well, I mean, moving from MSA to 3PAR, there's a significant cost per gigabyte difference. But having fewer devices managing more drives made simplified management to justify that?
Yeah, so there was a cost. So if we talk about price, you know, the original 3PAR devices, like the V400, they were a lot more expensive than the models we used afterwards, the 7400s, right? So I would say we had 4 400s that were really expensive, or at least more expensive than we wanted. But the 7400s are price-wise, at least with our discount, much, much closer to the MSA. Not the same price as the MSA, but at least closer to the MSAs, and made it really worthwhile to move for us.
Right. And instead of having 96 drives per pair of controllers, you've got several hundred drives.
Oh, yes. And with a lot of cost savings, too, because each MSA came with a bunch of fiber channel ports. And now we had a consolidation of fiber channel ports. I mean, fiber channel is not cheap. So
right.
We actually, going from the MSAs to the 3PARs, we actually reduced the amount of fiber channel ports significantly.
Wait a minute, you're a fiber channel SAN? I would have thought this would have been IP SAN, iSCSI or something like that.
No, it's fiber channel.
Because of throughput, latency, or...
Because of the bad taste in their mouth from ATA over Ethernet.
Yes. Wait a minute. The world is, you know, moving, I think.
Yes, but remember, this is what we started doing 10 years ago. And just full disclosure, I mean, the platform I just described, we're going to replace it soon with a completely new architecture, where we do it differently. But for the last, you know, 8-9 years, it was all fiber channel. I mean, it works really well. We had the fiber channel switches.
I have clients that are fiber channel suppliers, you know.
Biggest problem with fiber channel is paying for it.
Yeah, that's right. So you seem like you guys do a lot of proof of concepts for vendors, that more so than others, I would think. But I can't tell, really. How often do you do proof of concepts?
All the time.
And you're looking for a new technology that can provide cost, reliability, or performance advantages?
All of the above. So what happened a couple of years ago is every time we tested a device, we would find issues, and then the vendor was really interested in how we did our testing. I mean, imagine we have like 10, 12 racks of available to us for testing, right? So who has 12, 13 racks they can deploy against a new device as
a PLC? I mean, Howard is probably the only guy I know that has 10 or 12 racks.
I've only got 5.
See? Yeah.
And so what we noticed is that, you know, people like HP and IBM, because we talk to pretty much everybody, they started saying, hey, can you look at our device and see, you know, what do you like, what don't you like, and so on. And as we were doing that, we were getting higher and higher into the engineering teams with all these companies. And so we got a lot of information. And then we at some point, we had companies tell us, hey, you know, we're under NDA, but can you guys look at this? And we have this new thing, and can you try it out? And then before I know, I have VCs calling me up and say, hey, we heard from such and such that you tried, you know, product such and such in alpha. And what do you guys think? And is this good technology? And we kept on doing that. I talked to a lot of startups. Some of them don't even have a website. Others have a website, and others are in a stage where they're hitting the market. And it seems like we provide good technical feedback that they can use moving forward. And I came from R&D, so for me, it's all about technology. If I can learn something and I can help people understand what we do, and I can learn what they're doing, then I consider that like a win-win.
Yep. And Nuance Management supported you in that, which is good.
Yes. Most of the time, yes. Yes.
Well, and the other thing is you can help guide their technology to something that's more amenable to what you're looking for, too. I mean,
that's right. Yes. And I think that's we have a tremendous reputation within the company of making things work, right? So. And sometimes it's not a positive, where if something really, really goes bad in a different department, you know, they know where you live, right? So then you're in troubleshooting. But overall, I like technology. I like working with vendors. I like listening to what other people have to say. And you know, and that's why I pretty much decided to jump ship and say, why don't I focus even more on technology than I used to? You know, so far so good. You know, I really like it. There's no better way to say it.
So at Hyphens, you're consulting with these startups and companies about the technology?
Oh, yes. Yep.
You're also working with the HPC companies to, you know, identify technology that might be applicable to their environments, or?
Yes. It's interesting. I mean, I left on May 2nd, and I have companies calling me up, asking them to work with them. From an HPC perspective, because they believe they have something that should be good or a good fit for high-performance computing. So I get a lot of traction in those areas. We have to see if we can how we can make that all work. But there is clearly, at this point, no lack of interest.
Yeah, that's great. For a consultant just starting out, that's mind-boggling. I wish I was there. So you mentioned Lustre and GPFS is predominantly the two solutions that you would look at in this sort of environment.
Yes. You know, like I said, GPFS is kind of the older technologies out there. It has some things we don't like from a scalability perspective that new technology like Lustre is taking over. And GPFS started out as 100% block, right? So now they added features where there's object, you know, with clever safe acquisition, where they start to tier. Lustre is based on a more of a block slash object concept out of the gate, right? So it's more, the architecture is more modern and more targeted, if you ask me. And there are others out there, right? So there's a lot of homegrown file systems, but once you talk about petabytes and scalability, it comes back to a statistic, right? Do you want to be the person who is the number one or the first customer of a new startup that created a new high performance file system? You know, we did it before, to be honest. I mean, eight years ago, we did that with a company and we got burned significantly.
You know how they say you can tell the pioneers.
Yeah.
Pioneers are the guys with the arrows in their ass.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've been there, done that. I understand that completely.
And file systems take a while to mature.
Oh, yes. A lot of testing, a lot of validation.
Howard, do you have any last-minute questions to ask?
No, I'm getting it. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, this has been great. Frederick, you have anything you want to say to the Graybeards on Storage audience?
I would say keep listening. I think it's a great venue, and you know, let's keep it going.
And we like it a lot. And any of your listeners out there are interested in doing a review on iTunes for the podcast, that would be great as well and get us a little bit more exposure. Well, this has been great. It's been a pleasure to have Frederick with us here on our podcast.
Frederick, where can we find you on the Twitters?
I have two. The first, the personal one is FVHA, which is abbreviation of my name, so FVHA. And I also have one for my company, which is @hyphens.
That's great. And www.hyphens.com is your...
That's right. Yeah.
Your URL.
I'm working on it. You know, like you said, I didn't expect to have so much work and so much interest in the beginning. So my website isn't really there yet, but...
I think we can all say that.
Yeah. And we've been at it for years. Some of us decades. We won't go there anymore. All right. Well, next month we will talk to another startup storage technology person. Any questions you might want us to ask, please let us know. That's it for now. Bye, Howard.
Bye, Ray.
Until next time, thanks again, Frederick, for being on our show.
Yep, thank you for having me.